All right, it's July 3rd, 2006, and I'm David Brooks, the interviewer for the University of Montana's Oral History Project. This morning I'm talking with Howard Reinhart. And Mr. Reinhart, I was hoping you could start out by just telling me a little of your personal and educational background that brought you to Missoula and the University of Montana.
I grew up in Lewiston, Idaho, did an undergraduate degree at the University of Idaho, became a math major because I could graduate 6 months earlier than if I were a chemistry major. I then went to Washington State College, as it was then, later Washington State University, and took a master's degree there. Took a job with General Electric at the Hanford Project, worked there as a statistician for a year, was called back on a one-year instructorship at Washington State University, and there was encouraged to pursue a PhD. I went to University of Michigan for my PhD, was there from 53 to 57, and came to University of Montana in the fall of 57. I completed my PhD in the spring of 59, so I came here with a wife and a child and no dissertation.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I came to the University of Montana. I was recruited here by a man named Don Higwin, who was a professor at the University of Montana on leave at the University of Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And he recruited me for the University of Montana. Since I grew up in Idaho, I knew I wanted to come back
mm-hmm.
here to the West.
What was your PhD study?
I'm a statistician. My PhD dissertation was called The Use of Least Favorable Distributions in Testing Composite Hypotheses.
Got it.
not an earth-shaking document.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, what I proved is that a technique people were using did not have any generalizations at all.
Mm-hmm. So before getting to UM, you had been, you know, at Idaho, over in Washington, Michigan, as well as working for GE, so in the private sector. Talk a little bit about what the University of Montana was like when you first got here. I mean, you were a Westerner, so it probably wasn't that odd for you to be in Missoula.
No, it was not that odd to be in Missoula. There were, I think, a faculty of a student body of under 3,000.
Mm-hmm.
I think there were 9 people in the mathematics department. I was taken in immediately by the department, by the chairman of the department, a wonderful man named Ted Ostrom. I drove into town. I left my wife and baby in Ann Arbor. They were going to fly out later. I came to town, checked into a motel called Ted Ostrom, and he and his wife said, "How dare you stay in a motel? You come and stay with us."
Mm-hmm.
And they immediately made us feel at home. And then after my wife came, a man named Joe Hashisaki, who was on the math department, also took us in. We're great friends. The department was, the people were all very friendly.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very, very collegial atmosphere. I was surprised to learn when I came here that the university had also hired a man named Bill Ballard, who did his career here. Bill had been my professor at Washington State, and he too knew that he wanted to come west when he finished his PhD, and we both chose the University of Montana and have been very good friends ever since.
Mm-hmm. So I've heard that before, that things were very collegial, as you said, at the university at the time, and that was late 50s, 59?
Yes. 57.
57, right. You finished your PhD in 59.
Right.
What are some of the things that faculty did together that make you say that it was very collegial, besides just being friends around the department?
Oh, there was a house the university owned that had been a residence across from where the lodge is now, there, close to where the Grizzly Circle is. Mm-hmm. And that was available to us as a faculty house. We could go there in the middle of the morning and make our own coffee and sit around and talk. So we came to know people across the campus. There was a very small faculty union at that time, and through that faculty union I got to know Edmund Freeman, Ed Marvin, some of those marvelous old names. Mm-hmm. The campus was small enough that you knew people outside your department. Mm-hmm. The physics department was in the same building as the math department. Reuben Jeppesen was chairman of physics and also often chairman of the faculty. We didn't have a faculty senate then, we had a faculty with a chairman. And so I got to know those physicists. Mm-hmm.
So this was more than just the math department?
Much more than just the math department, mm-hmm. Yes. And then I think there was a newcomers group. There was a newcomers group, and so we met periodically. The president's wife at that time and the wife of the dean of faculty, Mrs. McFarland and Mrs. Chatland, visited all the new wives, came unannounced in hats of a morning, and that was something of a shock to the, mm-hmm. to the new new faculty wives. Mm-hmm. There is a story, I don't know if it's true, but I think it is, of a woman, a faculty wife, had a baby and had decided she wanted to climb a tree. So she left the baby in the house and climbed the tree in the backyard, and here came Mrs. Chatland and Mrs. McFarland. This woman stayed in the tree until they went home.
Didn't answer the door?
No, she couldn't answer the door. She was in the tree.
Right. So that sort of congeniality, it wasn't just accidental or by force of people's personality. To some degree, it was being cultivated.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Through having a faculty house and the actions of the president.
Yes, the newcomers group. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the newcomers group. And how about President McFarland? Was he part of that faculty congeniality? And was it just faculty, or did it include administration?
No, it was just the faculty. Mm-hmm. Well, most of the administration did some teaching. Mm-hmm. The Dean Chatland, who is dean of faculty, and his job is now split 100 different ways, I think, but he taught astronomy, and he taught applied mathematics in the mathematics department. Mm-hmm. And would come to the department an hour before his class and the whole court, mm-hmm. BS with the troops. Mm-hmm. So he was part of that. I did not know President McFarland. Mm-hmm.
Did he have much of a presence with the faculty?
Oh, well, not with me. Mm-hmm. He was, as you must know, a very controversial figure on campus. Professor Hatsushaki, whom I mentioned before, was special assistant to Dr. Chatland, and so I came to have a very favorable impression of President McFarland. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you say you have a favorable impression of him, but you also mentioned that he had a controversial time here.
Yes.
What are some of the things that you recollect that were part of that controversial place he held?
Oh. I think nothing particular comes to mind. No, I don't know why he was so controversial.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How about student and faculty relationships, both in your department and what you saw on campus?
Well, we were very fortunate when I came here at the number of mathematics majors we had and how good they were.
Mm-hmm.
The most notable of those was Jack Silver, who was maybe a 15-year-old undergraduate, went on to do a PhD at Berkeley, mm-hmm. and has been on the faculty at Berkeley practically ever since. A world-class logician. But a number of those really bright people went on to get PhDs. Three of them came back and to teach at the University of Montana, George McRae and Merle Maness and Keith Yale. Knew they wanted to live in Missoula.
Mm-hmm.
Went off to get a PhD and came back about as soon as they could.
Mm-hmm. What was the draw in the math department here in terms of specialties, areas of strength that would bring a world-class 15-year-old mathematician as other students who went on to PhDs and successful careers?
I think at that time, as when I was an undergraduate, and 15 years before that, people went to the university to go to the university, and they usually went to the state university. Jack Silver was a Missoula boy.
Mm-hmm.
Merle Maness was from Charlotte. George McRae was from Jordan. Keith Yale was from Livingston.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a choice. They can go to Bozeman or they can come to the University of Montana. Just didn't think about applying out of state. And it would come, and I think it was a very good thing that they came without a notion of a major. That was the case with me. I told you I chose between chemistry and mathematics on the basis of not a very good reason. So I get very discouraged these days when I look at the Missoulian with the stories about the high school seniors and what they're going to do. Well, what they're going to do is they're going to go to school X and study business administration with a specialty in overseas accounting. Well, 18-year-old kids have no business making those kinds of decisions.
Mm-hmm.
My own notion is you go to university, you get a liberal education, and then you decide what you're going to do with mm-hmm. your life. And that's what those young fellows were doing.
Mm-hmm.
So they, in the course of doing general education, they would take a mathematics course, find that there was really a very good faculty in the mathematics department. The classes were small. They took good care of those students, and they decided that they were bright people and do well at mathematics, and so decided to become mathematicians.
Mm-hmm. And was the school at the time providing exactly that, a very liberal education for most of its students? Was that its mission, would you say?
That's what I would say, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, even the professional schools, well, forestry was a very strong professional school, but they did require their students to take courses in arts and sciences, and they took standard botany and a whole raft of general education courses.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember, I don't think the business school was very big. School of Education wasn't very big. Pharmacy and journalism were very small.
Mm-hmm. And of course those have all grown.
Oh yes.
As has the math department.
Yeah, as has the math department.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a good school of fine arts. Again, people from the state who had some talent. They don't go off to conservatory. They come to the university.
Mm-hmm. So you were hired, you know, before you had finished your dissertation as a young professor. There were certainly older faculty there, but you eventually became the chair of the math department.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about your career in moving from young faculty to the chair of the department, a department that you've described as very capable.
Well, what happened, Ted Ostrom, who was the chairman of the department, I'll tell you a story about Ted Ostrom. When I was hired sight unseen.
Mm-hmm.
No, we were often the hiring was done without an interview. And Ted Ostrom was not a departmental secretary. So he typed his own letters. And he said, well, we might have you teach the elementary statistics course, and we might have you develop a statistics course for the biological sciences, and we might do this, and we might do that. And he signed it across the bottom. He had written in hand, this is a mighty letter. So, oh, we were charmed by Ted before we ever came. Ted, I don't know how much of this was associated with the McFarland leaving. I think a lot of hard feelings when McFarland left. Joe Hashisaki did leave, Hal Chatlin did leave, and that's because they were McFarland's right hand.
Mm-hmm.
Ted Ostrom was left about that same time for Washington State. And I think he was called there. He's had a very distinguished career there in geometry. Several of the other people left. It was very much a buyer's market in mathematics in those days. There was a very good number of theorists who went to Boulder. A couple of the other people left. And so, all of a sudden, I was one of the senior members in the department. The university hired a professor from the University of Washington, Art Livingston, who came to be interviewed for a position in the department. And he was being interviewed by the president, and the president offered him the chairmanship. He said, well, I'd come to be interviewed for a professorship. I will have to check with the department. And so he consulted with us. We were all quite young, the ones of us who were left, and we said we'd be happy with him as chairman. So he came and served as chairman for several years, and then he left. The Dean Coonrod wrote a memo saying that the department was run by a cartel of middle-aged professors. I didn't think of myself as a middle-aged professor, but I was supposedly part of that cartel.
Right. So you didn't disagree with the cartel part, just the middle-aged part?
Well, I disagreed with the cartel part, too.
Uh-huh.
Why
would he have said such a thing?
Who knows?
Uh-huh.
You have to interview him. as it was a buyer's market, we hired people we could. We actually hired some very good people. One of the good hires we made was Gloria Hewitt. I think the first black PhD from the University of Washington.
Mm-hmm.
She came here, and we hired her because she was a good mathematician. And she liked that very much.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a good department. Kind of in the nature of things with this cartel,
mm-hmm.
we took turns.
Mm-hmm.
And so
took turns at the chair.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
So Bill Myers was chair for 3 years, and I was chair for 3 years, and I think Bill Ballard was the next chair for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we weren't, we thought the department was run very democratically. We'd have department meetings, everyone with a vote, and the chair took care of the paperwork.
Mm-hmm. So you weren't necessarily guided by the chair as much as just coordinated by it?
That's right. There were some chairs around the campus, I think, acted as heads. I'd make a distinction between a head of a department and a chair of a department.
Mm-hmm.
And we definitely were not heads of the department. We were the chairs.
Mm-hmm.
The whole working group,
mm-hmm.
deciding what wanted to be done, and then it was up to the chair to represent to the dean or the academic vice president.
And what were the issues of the department? What were you deciding on? What were important things?
Oh, well, undergraduate education is always important.
Mm-hmm.
There were some difficult promotion cases that we had to deal with. I think every department will find occasionally that has hired somebody who just doesn't fit in, and you have to face up to those issues. The university at that time, this would be about the late 60s, I guess, was starting PhD programs. There was a PhD in geology. Psychology must have been one of the first ones to start. History started one early on then. Chemistry may have had one. Physics absolutely refused to have one. There was pressure on the math department to have one. Bozeman was initiating a PhD in mathematics. And we decided that there was a niche for training people who had PhDs who would become college teachers. We had in those intervening years a lot of NSF money to train high school teachers, give them Masters of Arts in Teaching Mathematics. Had some success at that, and I hired Bob McKelvey from the University of Colorado, who was also interested in those non-traditional kind of PhD. People give them a broad training, get them to write a good, solid thesis, but with the expectation that they would become college teachers.
As opposed to researchers?
Right.
Okay.
And so Bob came, and we put together a grant proposal to the National Science Foundation. Bob and I agree that we wouldn't have gotten that money if he hadn't been in contact with NSF and if I hadn't been in contact on campus.
Mm-hmm.
There was a good deal of resistance on the campus. There's the math department just giving a PhD for master's level work.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't that. It was a good solid scholarship.
And who was the resistance from to doing that? It seemed like a lot of the departments on campus were encouraged to get PhDs at the time.
Well, yeah, a lot of the departments were encouraged to get PhDs at the time without all the necessary resources.
Mm-hmm.
As you may know, I think history put its PhD in mothballs for many, many, many years,
mm-hmm.
Just because they felt that the research resources weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
Our grant called for 4 new faculty members, I think, with the university committed to picking up those money when the NSF money ran out. Well, you know, it's always been hard to get teaching lines in this university. So if there's the mathematics department going to get 4 new lines, that's going to raise a lot of eyebrows.
Mm-hmm. And who was raising those eyebrows?
Oh, everybody.
Everybody. Everybody who wasn't getting new lines. Yeah.
Oh, no, well, there was a lot of encouragement of us. Maybe if there hadn't been encouragement on the campus, we couldn't have done it.
Mm-hmm.
But those kinds of small disagreements, you have to disagree about something, they go away.
Mm-hmm. What year was that that the math department got a PhD?
Well, you shouldn't have asked me that because I didn't look it up.
Right. Approximately.
It was approximately.
Are we up to the mid-60s by now?
Oh, we're in the late 60s.
Late 60s.
Maybe 70.
Okay. And how's the math department in terms of growth at that point? I mean, that's a... You know, I've talked with other people about Vietnam War and losing students to that. And just the dynamics of... You know, there was a time in the university right about then where growth was really stagnant.
Oh, yes. Well, that was, in fact, that was one of the problems in the mathematics department. We didn't go into it with total enthusiasm, mm-hmm. either, because it was clearly going to take resources away from undergraduate education and put it into graduate education.
Mm-hmm.
And we were very proud of what we were doing with undergraduates. And I don't know what the number of math majors is now, but it's not high.
Mm-hmm.
So and we recruited graduate students. You know, when you have graduate students, the nature of undergraduate education changes because you have teaching assistants teaching the undergraduates,
mm-hmm.
rather than full professors.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Ted Ostrom talking to some student who had come in with a complaint. He says, you know, you don't know how lucky you are to be taking remedial mathematics from a full professor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's right.
Mm-hmm. And so that changed. There were more TAs.
More TAs, mm-hmm. yes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, continued to change since I've left the department. I think there are a lot more adjuncts and the PhDs are doing research and teaching graduate, mm-hmm. upper division and graduate level courses. It's kind of what happens.
Mm-hmm. And that was happening campus-wide as
yes.
those PhDs
yes.
came in.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So you eventually became Dean of Arts and Sciences.
Yes, I did.
Talk a little bit about your transition from a very democratic math department where just almost by default everybody got the chair for 3 years.
Yeah.
It was a rotating chair, it sounds like, to becoming the dean. That certainly wasn't a rotating position.
It was not a rotating position. I had a number of people across campus. By then I had been chairman of the Faculty Senate twice, and I had been president of the teachers union and had been involved in lobbying the legislature. Before I became dean, I was lobbying the legislature. We got big faculty raises. The buzzword was 12 and 12. It wasn't exactly 12% a year, but mm-hmm. There were big raises. And we also got money for the performing arts, mm-hmm. radio, television part. We got funding for that, and that was it was a surprise to all of us. The legislature thought that Bozeman was going to get a building for movies, and we had no chance of getting this performing arts mm-hmm. building, and we changed their minds. I think we really did change the legislature's minds.
How so?
Well, I think.
I mean, what did you do to? More specifically, what did you do to change their minds? What was your argument for RTV?
Well, my argument was that a good liberal arts school needs a performing arts component. That's an essential part of a liberal arts education, is the exposure to the performing arts. Mm-hmm. And that was my argument. I don't remember what the president's argument was.
Mm-hmm. That seems, you know, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like a fairly unique position to hear from someone in the math department, which strikes most people as very specific study. Somebody who might not really care what's going on over in performing arts, to hear that you're very much supportive of a liberal education and, you know, going to the legislature to fight for money for performing arts, radio and TV, but meanwhile you're in the math department. Is that a fair analysis?
Well, yes, I suppose that's a fair analysis. Some people would conclude that I must not have been a very good mathematician.
Well, I wasn't implying that.
Well, but some people infer that.
Uh-huh.
And, I did a little bit of mathematics research, but I was not primarily a research mathematician. Mm-hmm. I'm a mathematician by chance. Mm-hmm. If I could have seen through the microscopes, I might have been a biologist.
Right. Well, before I suppose we get to your time as the Dean of the Arts and Sciences, since you mentioned being Chairman of the Faculty Senate, President of the Teachers Union, representing Teachers Union or faculty at the legislature, what were your motivations for being involved in those activities that were certainly above and beyond just teaching?
Well, the presidency of the union seemed to me, I'd been a member of the union from its beginning, and these distinguished professors, and they had a vision of the role of the faculty in the university that struck me as being correct. Mm-hmm. And so when I was asked to be president of the union, I saw that as a chance to improve the conditions of the faculty. Mm-hmm. So that's why I was willing to do that.
What was that vision that you thought to be correct?
That the faculty would have more control over curricular matters, and that they would be paid accordingly. Mm-hmm. So there were the two issues: faculty control, faculty compensation. Mm-hmm. The Faculty Senate, I was, the Faculty Senate, I think it still does this way. Faculty are elected representing various divisions, the arts, the sciences, the professional schools, I think. And I was elected to represent the sciences, and that group elects its own officers. And I didn't learn very fast, I guess. I agreed to do it twice. I may be the only person who has been president of the faculty senate twice. Uh-huh. It's not a very rewarding job. Uh-huh. It wasn't when I was there.
Why is that?
The faculty does its business through committees. Faculty Senate listens to the neckties in Main Hall pontificate, and somehow it just was not very rewarding. I overstate that, actually. I was chairman of the Faculty Senate when Bob Panzer was president, and he was a marvelous man to work with. Mm-hmm. He knew that, coming through the channels he did, he knew that there was a lot about the teaching side of the university that he didn't understand, and he would listen to the Faculty Senate on those matters, and act accordingly. He was really very, very open, very receptive. Mm-hmm. And so that's probably why I became chairman a second time, is because I had enjoyed working with Bob Panzer. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard that about him.
Yeah.
In fact, I think everyone has spoken well of President Panzer.
Oh, yes.
Mainly for his ability to relate.
Yeah.
With faculty, students, yes. Even.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But the... when I was chairman of the Faculty Senate, it was during the Vietnam War, and that was when the ROTC building was occupied, and President Panzer gave a very good speech on the Oval, and I chaired a Faculty Senate meeting in which there was the motion before the House was to move ROTC off campus. Well, that was a very, very tense meeting, and it was a very close vote. We voted to ask them to leave the campus, and they never did.
So, mm-hmm. So it wasn't a binding vote. You were just asking them to leave, and they...
Yes.
Declined.
Yeah, that's right.
Huh. And did that issue simply dissipate with the end of the war?
Oh, it did dissipate. I think that there was a change in the attitude of the ROTC faculty toward the university. I think they tried to be more collegial.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the situation ROTC is now.
Mm-hmm. So you've definitely had, you know, a number of leadership roles in your time. And before I ask you about becoming the Dean of Arts and Sciences, I'd like to continue with that. How did that come about? And more specifically, you know, what were your inclinations or motivations to move out of teaching and into that more administrative role?
Well, there were two things happening, I guess. One of the things that was happening is that statistics, which is my discipline, was changing dramatically because of the advent of computers. All the statistics I had learned, it goes back to R.A. Fisher, came about because you couldn't do all the number crunching that needed to be done. So you invented ways to circumvent the computation. And R.A. Fisher was very good about that. He could see things in, he could see n-dimensional space. And so he could see how these points were congregating in n-dimensional space and could see what kind of computations would show the way they were congregating. So all of the things, well, students, T isn't due to R.A. Fisher, but essentially is, but the analysis of variance and the standard techniques that serve science very well for many, many years. The advent of computing, well, people still do analysis of variance, as they should, but a whole lot of statistics is now done using the computers. Very elaborate regressions that we couldn't do because they are number crunching. And so I was going to have to learn a whole lot about computing. And so I did learn basic programming, but didn't ever seem natural to me. I didn't really like doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was that. I was going to have to make a lot of changes in my own mathematical behavior if I was going to stay teaching mathematics. And then I thought being dean would give me a chance to serve undergraduate students, which has always been a love of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And well, it turned out not to be the case. I hired Jim Fleitner as associate dean, and he took care of improving undergraduate education, and I worried about troublesome faculty and troublesome students.
Mm-hmm. And how long were you the dean?
Well, I was acting dean for 1 year, and then I was dean for 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I said I was in the dean's office for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how Jim Fleitner did it for 13.
Mm-hmm.
Dick Solberg, who was my predecessor, did it for I don't know how many years.
Why do you say that? That you can't imagine that they did it for that long?
Because it's a very stressful job. It mm-hmm. was for me a very stressful job.
Mm-hmm.
I aged considerably. People remarked about the fact that I was aging considerably.
Mm-hmm.
I spent some time in the hospital.
Mm-hmm. What were the stressors of it?
Personnel.
Mm-hmm.
There was a time, it was a time of low budgets, and if I had any success as dean, it was because I worked very hard at figuring out ways to say yes, because I didn't like to say no.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent a lot of time saying no as well.
Mm-hmm. So when was that? What were those years?
Those years were 83 to 88, I think.
Mm-hmm. And if I recollect, that was sort of at the end of when budgets were tight and retrenchment, and things were maybe starting to be turned around in terms of the budget and hiring and student population.
Well, yeah, there was a retrenchment in 88, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But then there was another retrenchment several years later.
Mm-hmm.
So things things have certainly changed. I know that certainly not all the changes are for the better. I think it's wrong to put so much burden, financial burden, on the students.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the state doesn't recognize the value of having an educated populace and should be willing to pay a bigger share of the students' tuition. The notion, well, part of that though is this business of students coming out of high school deciding exactly what they want to be. So university has become a career track, and if all it is a career track, then the people on the career track should pay for it, I suppose. That's that argument. Mm-hmm. I don't like that argument. I don't like either part of that argument. I don't think that the university should be just a career track, and I don't think that students should pay so much for their education.
Hey, you know, you mentioned that early on in our conversation is your distrust or dislike of that, of students at 18 saying that they know what they're going to do, yeah, and the university trying to provide that for them as opposed to a liberal education. When did that change? When did the university's role change in terms of being an opportunity to get a liberal arts education to a career track?
I don't know when that was. That's been gradual. It's nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
There are some great liberal arts institutions that keep that old model and do work very hard they have a high tuition, but that's if your parents can pay it, and they have very good scholarship programs if your parents can't.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many schools now have needs-blind admissions. Some still do. And they're great schools,
mm-hmm.
But in general, the state universities, there are epidemics of things, and there was kind of an epidemic among state legislators of saying, "Well, university students ought to be paying for more of their education," and I don't know which comes first, the early decision about careers or making students pay for their education.
Mm-hmm. Speculate for me on that change and why the state would encourage the university to change in that way and subsequently have students take on more of the cost burden.
Oh, I think it may very well be a matter of just looking around and saying, where can we cut our budgets so we don't have to raise taxes?
Mm-hmm.
I think there's been in my lifetime certainly I think there's been a change in the attitude of people about the role of government.
Mm-hmm.
Notion now is that you keep them from taxing because they'll just waste your tax money.
Mm-hmm.
And it used to be that there are things that we have to do together, and the best way to do them together is to do them through our government and give them the money to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a non-reconstructed New Dealer.
Mm-hmm.
I still believe the FDR vision of going on through Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson of the role of the university in taking care of everybody. The role of this, not the university, of the country,
mm-hmm.
the government, taking care of everybody is very important. I think it's scandalous that we don't have universal health coverage.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the only thing I think is scandalous, but that's one of the things I think it's scandalous that the state doesn't support education the way it should, mm-hmm. way it ought to, at all levels,
mm-hmm.
K through 24.
And you know, you've mentioned already before that you think that the state doesn't appreciate the role of education or a general education, a generally educated population, I think is somewhat how you put it.
Yeah.
Why? I mean, what do you think are the benefits of that to the state, to the country, to the community? What role does a liberal education play?
A liberal education lets us see our continuity with the past, shows us the dangers that we can fall into if we're not careful, and we're not careful just now. And out of that arises a sense of community. And I think that sense of community is tremendously important. There was a greater sense of community on the campus when I came here than when I left in 88 or 89. But then, you know, a liberal education, a good liberal education, keeps people thinking, reading and thinking throughout their lives. And the only hope of being a good citizen is to read and think and talk. And if you're going to have something to say, then a liberal education is a basis for that. Mm-hmm. And and there are some self-educated people, certainly, who got their own liberal educations. There are a number. I run into them every once in a while. Some people who have never been to college, but he said, by the way, have you read this book?
Mm-hmm. So I want to pick up on something you mentioned there, that, you know, in the time you were on campus, there was a deterioration or demise of the sort of community on campus. You know, we started out by talking about some of the indicators of that congeniality, I think is what we were calling it then. What are some of the indicators to you that by the late 80s, when you were approaching retirement, that had evaporated or at least gone downhill?
Well, I think it started its evaporation during the Vietnam War.
Hmm.
When young people started asserting their rights to decide what their education was going to be. For a while, we dropped general education requirements. There were no general education requirements at all at this university and at a number of other universities. Students were devising their own majors. And the faculty, mostly the young faculty, bought into that. And said the notion that the faculty doesn't know any more than the students do about what the students ought to be doing. Partly that's right. You know, we're 40 years older than they are.
Right.
So we've got a whole different... Our memory of what it was to be 18 is very different from their experience of what it is to be 18. Actually, our memory of what it was to be 18 is probably very different from what it was when we were 18. But... So that dialogue between elder and younger, well, it's always had some tensions in it. They can be very good tensions.
Mm-hmm.
They should be very good tensions.
Mm-hmm.
But the young people have a lot to say to the older people.
Mm-hmm.
But the older people have a right to say, that's not a liberal education.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly my idea of a liberal education in part is, you know, maintaining some education or familiarity with the classics. So that speaks for some continuity.
Oh, heavens, yes. Actually, just now I'm reading the Odyssey.
Mm-hmm.
And that speaks so absolutely to us still.
Mm-hmm.
You don't study the classics just because everybody studied the classics. You study the classics because they have a lot to tell you.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting that you mention the Vietnam War and things, something social like that as part of the demise of faculty congeniality and that attitude on campus, because so often I've heard it said that it was just a product of larger student population and numbers alone make it harder for the school to be as personable.
Oh, well, that's certainly true. Mm-hmm. Yes. I think that's true of any community. It has to have a certain size to, critical mass is a good buzzword. Mm-hmm. But you see that on the campus. As it increases in size, there isn't so much need to get out of the forestry building, nor so much opportunity to get out of the forestry building.
Mm-hmm.
You see it in Missoula. Missoula was a nicer town when it was 30,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
Although it's done some marvelous things like cleaning up the river and the open spaces. It's trying very hard to keep from being any place USA, but there are big pieces of it that are any place USA.
Right, right. So I want to ask you something more specific about the university. You retired in 88, 89?
Something like that.
So that was just before, or just as Dennison was taking over as president? Just before?
Just before. I left the deanship just after Jim Cook came in.
Okay. So and there...
Then I taught one third time in the math department, but I wasn't really part of the faculty anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
And I think I left the deanship in 88 and I went back to the department full time and spent a semester in Japan. And Jim Cook was only president for 4.5 years, mm-hmm. I think. So, yeah, I was on my way out as Dennison was on his way in.
And so that 4.5 years of Cook is sort of what I want to ask about. I mean, you've talked a little bit about McFarland and Panzer, and they were both fairly long-term presidents.
Right.
Of course, Dennison is one of the longest-term presidents,
yes,
at this point. But in between there, we have a fairly quick succession of three presidents. Four? Three. Bowers, Bucklew, Cook.
Right.
Comment a little bit about those changes, if there were significant changes, those years. Why the short-term presidents?
Well, I don't know why Dick Bowers' presidency was short. He was the one I went to the legislature with at those, mm-hmm, those successful times. I don't know what the circumstances of his leaving were. I think Neil Bucklew had his eyes on the presidency of the University of West Virginia from the time he came here.
Mm-hmm.
And both he and Jim Cook were upwardly mobile.
Mm-hmm.
Each one of them came with an agenda for this place and used that as a stepping stone.
Mm-hmm.
I guess Bucklew brought general education back. I don't remember how things go. And did Cook build the stadium or did Bucklew build the stadium?
I think Cook maybe got the final funding for the stadium, was his role in it, and had it completed. He was here when it was completed?
I think so.
That was a little before my time in Missoula, but I think that's the...
I think that's right. Well, you ought to be reading history.
Well, I've read the one written history of the university, but of course it doesn't go up through that.
No, it stops, that's right. Yeah, it stops with McFarland, I think,
right,
doesn't it?
Right. So the next history is waiting to be written.
Yes. Well, one of the great pleasures of coming here in 1957 was I knew H.G. Merriam, mm-hmm. and a number of those grand old mm-hmm. people.
So that's kind of what I wanted to finish up with, is just any other stories or memories or people that you would like to mention from your time here.
No, I think I've mentioned the main ones.
Any lasting impressions from your time teaching and ministering on campus?
Teaching was almost always a pleasure. There would be some days when the students would, we were moving to large sections teaching mathematics for biological just in classes of 100, and I had a section of that, and I'd start to point out a very interesting application of something to biology. And there were a number of them. See, that wasn't going to be on the exam and would walk out in the middle of the class. So that was very distressing. Mm-hmm. But mostly the teaching experience was very good. Mm-hmm. And there were a good deal of pleasures in being dean. I think I was liked by the faculty. I knew them all by name. Mm-hmm. Name, I can match name and face mm-hmm. of all the faculty. Maybe Jerry Fetz can do that now. But those, again, were personal interactions with students, personal interactions with fellow faculty that were the importance. The collegiality. Mm-hmm. The bureaucracy, I suppose, is necessary, and you have to serve the bureaucracy, but it's not fun. Mm-hmm.
I guess there is one final thing I want to ask you, and that is that, you know, you're still a Missoulian. You still seem fairly well connected or informed about the university. What's kept you here? What's kept you interested in the goings-ons at the university after being retired for 16 years?
Yeah. Well, what's kept me here is we have a marvelous place in the Rattlesnake. My wife and I very much enjoy there. We can't imagine people going south for the winter or going south forever. Retiring off campus. If you're in Missoula, the university is still a big stakeholder in university, and so I'm consequently still interested in what's going on. Mm-hmm. I despair, but it'll survive.
All right. Well, thank you.
You're very welcome.